And so you conceive of the rise of consciousness from the primordial slime, up through the bestiality of the primeval human into the slow dawn of culture, the rise of the ancient civilizations, the great pagan cults close to nature, that drain your soul with human sacrifice and orgy, the steady progression of humanity from culture to culture, the refining away of the brute, the manifesting of the human, the overshadowing of the angelic. So does man rise, coming from God, and returning to God as a God. And remember, it is the garnered essence of all these experiences that makes man as he is today, and you have missed none of them, and they are all latent in your deeper memories. On this basis you build, into these primordial and primeval depths as into a rich and fertile soil you strike your roots downwards, that you may raise the flower of life above them. No root, no flower, and your flower is in proportion to your root, as any gardener will tell you. Reach deeply and consciously down into the primordial, and draw thence the flower of life. Do not fear the primordial, though it is terrible, do not despise it or condemn it, though it is base. In elemental strength must you be rooted. From blood sacrifice and orgy the mysteries arose. Today we work them on a higher rock, but the principles do not change. Upon the principles of sacrifice and polarity the mysteries are worked, changing from the physical, to the astral, to the mental, and to the spiritual as the ages pass. By thus transferring the focus of consciousness by the work of the imagination, backward up the great river of time to its source, down the great river of time in its flowing, so do you learn to identify yourself with your higher self, realizing the richness of the background from which you arose. Then consider the personality of incarnation, viewed from this standpoint. See it in perspective, realize that evolution stretches before you just as it stretches behind you, and that the life of the personality is but a day between a sleep and a sleep. See it in perspective and in proportion. You have had many personalities, you shall have many more. Personalities are ephemeral. There is but one thing that matters concerning the personality, that you should work out in that brief span between birth and death your measure of evolutionary experience. And how shall you do this? By realizing what manner of personality has been given you to work within this life, and what you need to do with it during the opportunity thus afforded you for development and progress. Consider, then, your own personality in the light of your evolutionary past, and remember that in the space between conception and maturity you recapitulate that past biologically as the unborn, psychologically as the immature. Through all the phases of your past you go until the full stature of your development is achieved as a fully grown and mature, minded human being. In each life you should add something to your stature, and it is your task to discover what this may be, and how you shall fulfill your destiny, for each one comes into incarnation with a destiny to fulfill, and this destiny you read in your own heart by learning what it is towards which it impels you in your deepest self. When you are true to the life urge within you, not what custom directs, but what life requires of you. Dare to be your true self in your own mind, even if the circumstances of your life deny you the outward expression thereof, for action in the outer world is but a mirror in which we see reflected back to us that which is within. Be true to yourself within yourself, and life will reflect opportunity back to you. Deny your true self within yourself, and life will reflect back to you frustration. Only when you are your true self, only when you have come to terms with your real nature, can you stand upright upon your feet, in equilibrium, security and inner peace. Thus do you perform the process of self-examination in the light of cosmic time, and then, having examined and adjusted yourself to your true self, you take your personality in hand and make it your mask. Like the magical images in the temples of Atlantis, you make of your personality your instrument of expression. You mold and fashion it, you work upon it until it becomes the perfect ashlar, the perfected instrument. But it cannot be your instrument so long as consciousness is centered in your feelings and desires. Learn to disregard these feelings. Live in your inner self. Learn to break in your desires, that they may carry you forward on the path like a strong beast of burden. And as to the sensations of the body, master the art of relaxation, whereby they are reduced to a minimum, freeing the consciousness for the higher contemplation. The work of polishing the rough block of temperament into their finished ashlar of character is achieved by dwelling in meditation upon the ideal you have set yourself, and by thought control. Control the imagination and you control the emotions. Build daily. Build steadily. Build systematically. Do not accept your feelings as your masters. Learn that the feelings can be mastered by the higher mind, and bring them into subjection to your directing judgment. This is the work of the exempt adept, who has freed himself from the bondage of his feelings. For the work of the higher magic you must have such thought control, so that you can regulate the imagination, and through imagination the feelings. When you have worked the rough ashlar into the perfect ashlar, it is then ready to be loosed. The loose or cramp is the ring, bolt of metal which is set in it, by means of which it can be hoisted into position in the edifice. The loose or ring, bolt represents the psychic faculties which link the personality with the higher consciousness and enable it to perceive with the eyes of the higher self on the inner planes. Thus must you work on yourselves to be stones in the edifice of the temple. The exempt adept is characterized by his poise and unruffled serenity and peace, for peace that cannot be disturbed is the sign of self-misery. The magus is master of himself before he can be master of the lodge, otherwise he will wreak destruction with his magical power. It is through this inner serenity and peace that the ease in working comes which was indicated to you as the ideal at which you should aim, having achieved efficiency. It is something to achieve the control of the outer expression of the feelings. This is demanded of civilized man in social life, but inner control of the feelings which harmonizes them into peace is demanded of the initiate for his magical work. Work upon yourselves till you learn the lesson of peace. Accept the tasks and the conditions which your destiny allots in each incarnation. Work contentedly and faithfully within your limits. For not in one life can you expect to compass the whole range of evolutionary experience. Adapt your way of life to the means available on the physical plane, but in your inner life of freedom, the freedom of the whole are of the heavens and the whole range of evolutionary time, freedom of realization, and freedom in the building power of the imagination. Thus shall the soul to be freed from its shackles, disciplined in matter, but free, winged in the ether, in self, realization find your inner freedom. How much or how little of your realization can be given expression in a single incarnation is immaterial. You have many incarnations, all you need, in which to work out your realizations. Never let your incarnation limit your realization, for it is your realization that builds your incarnations through the power of the imagination. What you realize in this incarnation will be expressed in the next incarnation. Your present life teaches you the discipline of form. Learn to work within the limits set you by circumstances. But the creative imagination is free, within the limits of realization, to build for the future. Headline, picture text, November 1942, faced by the seemingly unstoppable advance of Montgomery's tanks and troops, Rommel's Afrika Korps is forced to retreat. The Allied Expeditionary Force lands in North Africa. It may here be of interest to refer back to Dion Fortune's comment at the end of 1941, in letter number 95, to the effect that she was withdrawing from outer court activity to some extent, in order to undertake more inner work. This type of mediumistic work was plainly a part of it, but not always in terms of a general address as in the last example. Communication could be more personal and specific, as may be seen from the following notes that were made by a close associate at what was plainly an interview with an inner plane communicator via Dion Fortune's mediumship. It commences with a personal note to C.R. Gamble, the editor of Light, the significance of which is no longer apparent, but which serves to show that all such communication from inner plane sources was not confined to general teaching or cosmic abstractions, but that personal advice and guidance was available when appropriate. We then have a series of remarks upon the international situation at the time, which happens to be the eve of the fall of Singapore. Whether this is an example of prophecy is open to question. By the time this communication was given, the fact may already have happened, or certainly been imminent. This is in the context of comments on a number of more distant events that are envisaged, although these are in the tone of speculative thought rather than specific predictions. Some of what was then envisaged has come to pass. The loss of British imperial and colonial possessions, for example, which would have been by no means obvious at the time. Other ideas, such as international control of means of communication and transport, have not, although there is still plenty of time for this to happen as the world shrinks with the advance of technology, and international cooperation becomes more imperative in various areas of concern. This type of inner plane communication also gives us an insight into the general drift of Yon Fortune's latter weekly letters, which become more concerned with the challenge of post-war reconstruction than with the press of current events. The communication concludes with a more symbolically developed sequence of remarks upon aerial warfare in an age of air. It seems likely from these comments that they come from one of Yon Fortune's inner plane communicators who had been killed at Ypres in the First World War, and who would have had his views on the training of generals. It was a firm belief proclaimed by one senior commander of the time that air power would never replace cavalry. This strategic theory has hardly stood the test of time, but it is doubtful whether argument along the lines of the communicator's symbolically based comment would ever cut much ice in conservative military circles, then or now. One might also note that the communicator, by implication, does not seem to anticipate that the warfare currently in hand is likely to be the last on Earth. In this, his powers of prediction have certainly not been found wanting. Communication received February 14, 1942, tells CRC that organized opposition is at an end. He should strive to reconcile himself with those who opposed him, but there is one woman, the center of the opposition, who will probably prove irreconcilable. On the international situation, there is no need to be anxious. A failure in the morale of the Allies is the only thing that could lose the war, and that is unlikely. The tides of destruction or other purgation are not intrinsically evil. Evil has no cosmic support, but these tides test and prove all things. They expose and wash away all that is weak and defeat. This is a period of reform. You will observe they are seeking out all the weak spots in the Allied organism. They are re-exposing the effete leadership of the nation, and they are tearing up by the roots the colonial empire in Asia. The you have peoples capable of a higher culture who have not been afforded the opportunity for that culture, but have been exploited in the interests of commerce. That which we lose now will not be restored to us. Asked if the inference was that it would be wrong to fight a long war to recover possession, the answer was, yes, Singapore is going. NB, the news of the fall of Singapore was announced on Sunday, February 15, 1942. The rightful owners will resume ownership, but there will be strategic points all over the world which will be held by the United Nations for international commerce and international policing, and they will be mandated. For the whole of the new age turns on the concept of the ownership of the land by the people versus the ownership of the people by the land. So you will see a great many places hitherto under English ownership reverting to the original owners, but they will not be under Axis ownership. Because the soil owns the people, not the people the soil, therefore there are very big changes coming in the organization of this country. I think that in the near future Germany will collapse in Europe, and that England will lose her foothold in the Far East, never to recover it. There will be drastic changes in the government and in social organization, and it will be all to the good. The subsequent reconstruction will be based on an agreement between those like-minded powers inviting the adherence of all who share their views. There will be arrangements between them on the interchange of commodities and the organization of law and order, and it will be implemented by means of a network of international trade routes over which goods and persons will move freely in the name of the Associated Nations and without regard to local frontiers. It was here pointed out that there was considerable difference of opinion as to whether Germany could be associated with the free nations after the war, and the communicator said, Prussia is not like-minded, but there may be parts of Germany which are. There will be a ruling hegemony of the nations who win the war, and these trade routes will be international, and at strategic points will be established great depots of exchange, international markets. These will also be centers of an international police, force maintaining order. This trade will move freely over the whole globe so that access to the sea will not matter and nations will not need to fight for it. The sea will be the international highway of all nations and depots, harbors and strategic points will be held by the authority of the Commonwealth of Nations just as England holds Gibraltar. Equally, international highways, railways and inland waterways will be under international control. Thus in losing her strong points in the Far East, England sacrifices nothing save causes of friction and sources of expense. The Commonwealth of Free Nations will secure strategic points all over the world to prevent future aggression and to aid the development of trade. And the test of righteousness is universality. It is the welfare of the common man all over the earth that is the basis on which the strength of the Commonwealth of Nations rests and whom it exists to serve. The Aquarian Age develops in the element of air. It is in the air that the keys are to be sought. The wars of the present and of the future will be fought in the air, with land and sea forces as supporting units, not the air force as the support of the land and sea forces. That is the key to all the disasters suffered. England cannot win on land, she is a sea and air power. It is in the air that the future lies because Aquarius is an airy sign. It is not a case of air power supporting an advancing army but of air power making the attack and the land forces consolidating the gains. Therefore the strategy of victory in this war must be based on the conditions of aerial combat. The land forces must be considered as supporting forces. The land forces cannot operate without the air force but air forces can operate without land forces but cannot consolidate their gain. The air marshals must learn to use the land forces to follow up and consolidate the gains obtained in the air, which is the battlefield of the future. To instruct the generals in the use of the air arm in conjunction with the work of the troops would be a waste of time, even if it were possible to instruct a general. When a man holding general's rank was drained, he was not a general, and you can't teach an old dog new tricks. The trouble is that the men in command of the fighting forces are pussies by virtue of their seniority. Wherever their conditions of the earlier age prevail, they are competent. Wherever the conditions of the new age prevail, they are unable to perceive their nature and are therefore unable to grapple with them. The war will be fought and won in the realms of the air and of the mind, that meaning in the sphere of morale. The democracies belong to the new age. The Axis powers represent the recrudescence of ebbing forces whose day is past, therefore their time in any case is short. For the tides of life are against them. The flash back of the previous extract provides a glimpse into the informal inner, outer plane relationship that pertained to the inner recesses of the fraternity. From this we can appropriately turn to an article in the second monthly letter which provides detailed remarks, from an inner plane source, on how such communication is made, and some of the consequences that may arise from it. Headline, picture text. Monthly letter number 2, for November 1942. Modus operandi of transcommunications. Received through the mediumship of Dion Fortune. It is quite simple if you understand the rationale of hypnosis. The medium, by first relaxing completely and then concentrating on the image of the communicator, disconnects the conscious mind from the subconscious. This is done by gathering the focus of attention to a single point and holding it there until the mind ceases to register. This disconnects the levels of consciousness. The point on which attention is concentrated is the image of the communicator. Consequently, when the directing mind is disconnected, as it were, the subconsciousness has this image imprinted on it. The communicating entity, who is a mind without a body, visualizes his own image, and the two images being identical, a telepathic rapport with the medium's subconsciousness is established. The subconscious mind of the medium then dramatizes the personality of the control. The control conveys ideas to the subconscious mind of the medium telepathically. These ideas are archetypal or abstract. That is why it is so difficult to convey names or numbers. It is the dramatized, artificial personality created by the mind of the medium which talks to you. If there is within the scope of the medium's knowledge the material out of which the trance address can be made, it is utilized. If the material is lacking, a symbolic method of presentation has to be used. persons who are naturally of mediumistic type are quite different from the trained medium used by a mystery school. The trained medium is taught how to dissociate the levels of a well-knit mind, and how to take the initial steps in the dramatization of the personality of the communicator. These acts are voluntary, whereas in the natural medium they are involuntary, and that person is only saved from the consequences of dissociation of personality and the dramatization of the secondary personality by the intervention of a spirit guide. In the absence of a spirit guide, the dissociation of the personality and development of the secondary personalities follow the ordinary course of a psychopathic manifestation. It frequently happens that a medium of this type, who has worked well under a spirit guide, may lose contact with that guide and then become merely a schizophrenic. Or the guide may sometimes be in touch with the medium, sometimes not, and so the quality of the trance will vary. Trance communications should always be judged by their intrinsic content, because once the image has been built, the subconscious mind of the medium can produce a perfectly good simulacrum of the communicator. In the light of this explanation, you will see why it is that a medium of an unevolved type of personality has for control a child or a savage, for the limitations of the medium's personality are such that these are the adequate presentations. Such persons, being themselves children at heart, the communicator is limited by the caliber of the medium, save in the matter of symbolic presentation, of which the prophets of the Old Testament afford an example. The question of language presents no real difficulty because the ideas are formulated by the control in terms of the higher mind, which has an abstract type of mentation. The translation into concrete terms takes place in the medium's subconscious. Terms or names with which the medium is unfamiliar have either to be spelt out by the communicator or communicated phonetically. The personality of the communicator, however, if well dramatized, should come through very clearly and be able to establish direct telepathic contact with the minds of the sitters. This plays a very important part in their development. Are they to know how questions, written, are answered? If the answer causes their hearts to burn, the link is made. That is the test. Personal advice is seldom given. You are to judge. It is a question of the principles underlying a case, with which we deal. For those who are high in the mysteries, things can be done to facilitate their work that could not be considered in the lower grades. Intervention from the higher planes concerns the nature of destiny and whether they can co-operate intelligently. The laws of destiny are mastered by observance. In regard to a written question, if you bring it to me from someone who is seeking instruction and I answer it, a link is established, and in due course that person may be accepted for personal instruction. The results are twofold. The teaching of the doctrine is one thing, and can be conveyed by the written word, but the power of the presence is another thing, and the written word only partially conveys it. X is a man with mystical contacts, and illuminated. He is the holder of a position he invoked, and I am come in answer to his prayer. It is not only a matter of what practical services he can give, but a matter of his past incarnations and his contacts. Therefore, do not consider it from a purely utilitarian point of view. You know the old story of the person who uses the magical words and is startled by the appearance of the spirit. This man, using a true formula, made contact, much or little may come or it, but he is entitled to his opportunity. Results are his affair. It is not your responsibility, nor mine. You and I are channels, not sources of contact. Deal with him as originally planned, make no difficulty, let the matter work itself out. Give him the opportunity as promised. What use he makes of it, or fails to make of it, is his affair. The man who gives the correct password and knocks at the door of the mysteries may not be refused, even if he gives them in ignorance. But in this case they were not given in ignorance, but in a moment of vision. Let that impulse then set going take its course. A man has more than one incarnation. Give to him that asketh of you. I am thinking of the help he needs, which should be given to him without question. Consider him as a soul lost in a dark forest who will go down into grievous darkness if he cannot have a helping hand. You may have wondered at the form my help took, that, being arrogant, he met with arrogance. With the froward I will show myself froward. What is said is not forgotten, and it will do its work, for it is a law of my being that I may not deny truth, and truth takes the responsibility. I may often have occasion to say to people what they may not like. It is not for you to soften the blow or turn aside the surgeon's knife. December 1942. Following successful experiments with nuclear fission, Roosevelt orders a stop to the sharing of atomic secrets with the British. Dion Fortune's use of mediumship in esoteric work brings into question its use in the spiritualist movement, where it is used in a different context and largely for a different purpose. There had been an uneasy period in the attitude of the fraternity towards spiritualism, leading at one point to a ban on members taking part in any such activities. This had led to the resignation of those who felt compromised by such a ruling. A considerable amount of rethinking had obviously gone on in the meantime, resulting in a long article on the subject by Dion Fortune in the Third Monthly Letter. She had also, over the past few months, started to give lectures at the headquarters of the Marylebone Spiritualist Association. Monthly Letter Number 3, for December 1942. The Fraternity of the Enlightened Spiritualism. It is desirable at the present juncture to make clear to our members and friends the position of the Fraternity of the Inner Light with regard to spiritualism. To those who have knowledge of both movements, it is obvious that they are the two sides of the same coin. Spiritualism is empirical occultism. Occultism is traditional spiritualism. The methods and tone of the two movements differ, the one being propagandist and the other exclusive. In the past, both had their separate tasks to perform, and could only perform them separately. Occultism had to keep alive and increase our heritage of psychic knowledge, and spiritualism had to introduce the same concepts to the popular mind in a form that could be appreciated by people whose past incarnations had given them no subconscious aptitude for understanding the invisible realities and who were making their first approach to the path. Both movements were under the jurisdiction of the Great White Lodge, but were carried on by different groups of masters on the inner planes and their servers and pupils on the physical plane. Independent organization was necessary, as the one movement aimed at the widest possible publicity in order to influence popular opinion, which it has done successfully, and the other still needed to remain in seclusion till public opinion had undergone the preparation that was the work of the spiritualist movements. During the last Great War, spiritualism came into its own and accomplished its mission, and its contribution to human thought is now an accepted part of our culture. In this war, occultism is coming into its own in turn, consolidating the ground pioneered by spiritualism. The masters of the Great White Lodge have given instructions to the brethren charged with the direction of both movements that the time for co-operation has come, and the two movements are to make contact at their periphery, like two circles meeting and slowly blending. There will for a long while yet be much of the spiritualistic movement which has no tinge of the occult philosophy but limits itself to research into psychic phenomena and the proof of survival, furnishing inquirers with evidence and the bereaved with consolation. There will also be a certain proportion of occultism, the greater mysteries, which will continue to function in seclusion because the world is not yet ready for it. But there will be an unbroken line of approach from the propagandist aspect of the spiritualistic movement right through to the arcana of occultism. Both movements will be enriched thereby, the vast, undeveloped wealth of tradition being placed at the disposal of spiritualists, and the highly specialized gifts of psychics and mediums being made available for the work of practical occultism. It is desired by the masters that every effort should be made, both individually and collectively, to break down the distrust and antagonism that has so long prevailed between the two movements. It has no justification, unless trade competition be considered a justification. Occultists should familiarize themselves with the methods of the spiritualist seance. They would find that they were by no means on unfamiliar ground, but had much to learn from a more highly developed technique than is customary in their own movement. Spiritualists equally should be offered opportunities of gaining first-hand experience of practical occultism. Having thus explained the essential unity of the two movements, We also need to make clear the factors in which they differ, not through antagonism, but through specialization. Spiritualism is concerned primarily with the task of bringing the subtler forms of existence into touch with the physical plane through the work of its mediums and psychics, whose development for this purpose has been the object of a vast amount of study and accumulated data of experience.